Joshua Norton is Professor of Philosophy at the American University of Beirut. His work focuses on the ontology of identical particle systems in quantum mechanics and their relation to Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles, the ontology of loops in loop quantum gravity, and the nature of space-time in general relativity and developing theories of gravity. Joshua, what does it mean to provide a quantum description of gravity?
There's a historical process by which one uses in quantizing or attempting to quantize physical fields. Loop quantum gravity, loop with a L-O-O-P, loop quantum gravity is an instance of the historical approach started by Dirac. We successfully quantized a couple different fields this way, and one hopes or attempts to quantize gravity in the same way. So one takes the metric field and it plugs it into this process that Dirac describes. Now, this isn't the only way to quantize gravity. There are other approaches. In this talk, I guess I'll only be talking about the loop quantum gravity approach. What one does is it takes this fundamental field, the metric field, and tries to build a Hilbert space of states which describe the metric field. This process generates lots of difficulty. Three special constraints get generated through this process, and these three constraints have to be mathematically solved in order to get the Hilbert space of states. I only say these things to say that the historical process that one normally uses when one is thinking about quantizing a physical field, and that's Dirac's process. The second reason I bring up is that it's a mathematically difficult thing to do in general, and especially in the case of the metric field or gravity. Now, note that I've equivocated two terms. I've equivocated this idea of the metric field and gravity, and I'm not sure if the readers or the listeners are clear on the distinction or why I've equivocated those things. So I'll explain that in a moment, what the relationship is between gravity and the metric field as it shows up in general relativity. But the idea is you take some sort of physical theory, it has some physical fundamental fields, and you provide a quantum description using Dirac. There's just this process, you turn the crank and a quantum description of the field hopefully comes out. In the case of general relativity, that field, the fundamental field, just is the metric field. In general relativity, one has, in a sense, gotten rid of the physical force of gravity and replaced it with a dynamical background geometric structure, i.e. space-time. So one often hears in general relativity that space-time is curved or that gravity just is curved space-time. There's a sense in which there is no physical force called gravity per se, but we effectively describe the world as though there is such a force, when in reality all that's happening is space-time is curving. And we describe that curvature through the dynamical nature of the metric field. The metric encodes space-time relationships between objects.
So what does it mean then to relativize quantum theory? Because obviously you've given the distinction between the two and how they use metric and mathematics. One's obviously a more dynamical approach that involves a background in which gravity isn't a physical force per se, like in general and special relativity. And the other one treats it more in that way. So with that in mind, what does it mean to relativize quantum theory and what would that entail?
Yeah, you know, this idea providing a quantum description or, you know, loop quantum gravity, you have two notions there, at least two notions. You have quantum mechanics and gravity, and the gravity we're speaking about is the gravity that's in general relativity. So you said, or in previous conversations, this marriage between general relativity and quantum mechanics, and as in all marriages, compromises have to be made. It's not just gravity that gets quantized and so, you know, gives something up and compromises. There's a sense in which quantum theory itself gets a relativized structure. And not necessarily all of quantum mechanics. I mean, this would be the goal to relativize all of quantum mechanics. In general, relativistically, relativize all of quantum mechanics. In the case of loop quantum gravity, all the claim is doing is you're providing a quantum theory, i.e. the quantum theory of the metric field, which is suitably relativized, i.e. suitably background independent or independent of some sort of absolute objects. So what does it mean then to relativize quantum theory? In this case, it's to provide a quantum theory of some structure, in this case, the gravitational field or the metric field, which doesn't rely on a fixed background structure, be that space-time or space, but most importantly, time. There is no fixed temporal direction against which the quantum processes are dictated or stipulated to evolve with respect to. And this is the first hint that there's going to be some meaty problem there.
Some physicists think space-time is essentially doomed because of this. I mean, how much of a problem, is it? And what side is more likely to give in having to compromise between the two? Because quantum mechanics has been proved over and over again in terms of various experiments you can do for quantum mechanics. It's a very precise theory, and some people think that space-time will, under Einstein's paradigm, will have to be replaced. You got any thoughts on that?
If I had to speculate, it seems that space-time, or at least, as you said, under the paradigm described by Einstein, will have to give way more than we'll see a sort of paradigm change in how we formulate quantum theory. But that's not to say that, well, I'll say two things. The first is quantum theory might need to be changed and modified precisely because we presumably will not have a fixed temporal direction against which to describe evolution or dynamics. So the whole notion of quantum systems evolving, the whole notion of what a Schrodinger equation means without a background structure will need to be modified and changed. There are proposals for how to do this, relational sort of variables, evolving constants, complicated mathematical things that I have no right to speak about as a philosopher. Now, the second thing I want to say is, you know, you're correct in saying that quantum theory is a highly precise theory, one which we have some of the greatest evidence in support of. I would also like to say this layman's concept of space and time isn't without its empirical backing. There's a sense in which we are all acquainted with space and time more intimately than we are with any of the data or evidence which supports quantum mechanics. You and I phenomenologically experience the world as though there is space and time. There's a sense in which all of our experiences are washed within the evidential paradigm of a space and time structure. So I think it might be wrong to say that quantum mechanics has a greater evidential base than space and time. Our phenomenological experiences seem to be like wrapped and washed and structured by a space and time paradigm.
Yeah, in terms of temporal asymmetry and obviously linear time, obviously we don't live in yesterday. Phenomenologically, cognitively, yes, we experience time as a arrow of time. That's any human, obviously, just by definition, in terms of any kind of interaction or any kind of thinking is based on a measurement of time. Obviously, we've been talking now for 5 minutes. So any human with a mind that has the capacity to cognitively process can appreciate the point of how we appreciate time in that respect. Now, you talked a little bit about loop quantum gravity. If loop quantum gravity is about gravity, then what specifically has this aspect got to do with time?
Good. Yes, this gets back to the original sort of equivocation that I warned about, where I switch back and forth between loop quantum gravity or quantum theories of gravity as being about gravity, but then also what's called quantizing the metric field, where the metric field has to do with spatial and temporal distances between objects or events and space and time. So what does it have to do with time? Well, everything. In general relativity, gravity, as I said, is reduced to curvature within space and time. So when one thinks about gravity, one is actually speaking about is the metric field, where the metric field encodes spatial and temporal distances, areas, lengths, volumes, durations of time. So when one is providing a quantum description to gravity, one is technically describing a quantum description of spatiotemporal geometry. Spatiotemporal geometry being both spatial geometry and also temporal geometry. When it's providing a quantum description of space itself, of time itself.
As a consequence of this, what does quantum gravity tell us about any new potential conceptions of time that we might be able to bring to the table?
Yeah, good. There's a lot. And it's a knotted, complicated question and issue that stands at the heart of how we interpret mathematics and what it is that we take to be the basic physical concepts of our theories. So I'll start with the historical problem. The historical problem that arises, technically, anytime you provide a Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity, you can generate this problem. But it comes to life most popularly once we try to quantize the theory. What ends up happening is, I mentioned earlier that when you push general relativity through Dirac's method, you end up at least, I said three constraints earlier. It's two with respect to the original variables. We end up using new variables, Ashtekar's variables. And when you use Ashtekar's new variables with Dirac's process, you end up getting three constraints. One of these constraints ends up being titled or called or interpreted as the Hamiltonian constraint. Now, there's an interesting question as to why we ought to call it that. I won't get into that question, but once we are committed to calling this constraint the Hamiltonian constraint, the interpretation of that constraint entails that the physical states which are describing some sort of quantum geometric reality, but these states don't evolve over time. There's two ways that one can get to that interpretation. One is they interpret the Hamiltonian constraint as being a kind of Schrodinger equation, where the right-hand side of a Schrodinger equation is supposed to have a time derivative, and it does not. And so one interprets it, rather on the right-hand side of that equation, one just has a zero. What that means is on the left-hand side, you have what's called the Hamiltonian constraint, and the Hamiltonian constraint acts on the quantum states of your quantum geometric system, i.e., just the states of your system, and it annihilates them. It destroys them. It sends them to the value of zero. One interprets this as saying that the states don't evolve over time, i.e., that the time derivative of the state just is zero. Now, like I said, there's different ways of getting to that. That's the most common interpretation. One often interprets that result as saying that time disappears. One will hear this said very commonly. Question is, what does it mean for time to go missing in this context? It is surely the case that the right-hand side of the Schrodinger equation is zero, but does that mean there is no time variable? Does that mean that there is no time dimension within the mathematical formulation of the theory? Those latter two questions are answered in the negative, i.e. there is still a time variable, i.e. the mathematical structure which is describing a physical system still has a little t coordinate. There is still four dimensions, one of which is, depending on how we've done what's called a 3+1 split of the manifold, one of those dimensions is still putatively designated as the time dimension, at least roughly. If you can see me, I'm kind of shaking my hands here in some sort of ambiguous, sketchy sense that that's the time dimension. So it's not that time has disappeared, at least with respect to our mathematical formulation of the physical theory, but really what it is that we have interpreted this little t here as no longer worthy of being called a time variable. The best way to think about this is, so this is what's called the frozen formalism, or the problem of the frozen formalism. You have this Hamiltonian constraint. The Hamiltonian is supposed to presumably describe how physical states evolve over time. The right-hand side of this quote-unquote Hamiltonian constraint, which is supposed to have a time derivative, it doesn't, i.e. the states are frozen over time. One then does this. They say, look, whatever time is, an essential – one never usually does this explicitly. One kind of has to read between the lines. But whatever time is, it must be that thing against which physical processes evolve. And if our quantum geometry of loop quantum gravity does not evolve with respect to this coordinate t, then that coordinate t must not represent time after all. We were mistaken about what time is. Time isn't some global coordinate that we could define ahead of time that's part of this background manifold. It has disappeared from our formalism, not because there's no t's in our formalism, but because the t's which do show up are improper to describe the nature of time.
It's not that time has disappeared in these equations, it's just the way time can be used as a variable.
Sure, or I'd rather say it's more that how it is that we interpret these variables. It might be the case that time still exists within the mathematics. The question is that time is no longer represented in the mathematics by the variable t. Where time is, or how it is that time is represented within the mathematics, is yet to be determined. That's what many researchers are trying to do. They're trying to extract some other mathematical structure with which they could use to model time. And so it's the case that, like, there's still, if one reads things, some sources make it sound as though the time variable disappears. That's not the case. The time variable is still there, i.e. the thing labeled by t is still sitting in our equations at different places. There's still coordinates called t. The question is, is it proper to interpret that little t as time? Or is it just some random coordinate that doesn't have the physical interpretation of time? So the better way to think about it is that rather than saying that the time variable disappears, which isn't true, to say that the time variable is no longer appropriately interpreted as representing physical time. What physical time is needs to still be extracted from the theory. How does a theory encode physical time is still a task with mathematical physicists are working hard at finding or completing.
It leads to the final question, which is, does the problem of time here just reduce to a technical mathematical problem?
Yeah, good. In my opinion, the problem of time is not just a technical problem within loop quantum gravity, as though it were just some math problem that we need to figure out. In my mind, even if you were able to find a structure that you can quote unquote model time with, you still don't have geometry. At the beginning of this process, we took the metric field, which represents spatial and temporal distances and lengths and areas, and we got rid of it. We threw it away. And in its place, we provided a quantum mechanical description, something of geometry, something which mimics and looks like classical geometry in certain limits at certain scales for certain states. But most of the time, those quantum states have their own nature, and it's hard to interpret them as describing anything that looks like our classical or common notions of areas, volumes, lengths, and durations of time. Now, if that's the case, then our quantum states in loop quantum gravity describe quantum distances or quantum geometric structures. They do not describe things which are properly interpreted as representing temporal durations, for instance. Now, this is what happened at the very beginning when we quantized the metric field. We've already thrown away a lot of physical information, a lot of physical structure. That being the case, that even if you were to find some structure and you wanted to interpret it, this is as we're trying to solve the frozen formalism problem, as we're trying to solve the quote-unquote canonical problem of time. Even if you provide some variable, some structure with which you think does a good job of modeling time, you still don't have something called temporal duration. You still don't have lengths of time precisely because you provided a quantum description for it. So you still have to wrestle with the question is, does that structure, whatever structure you end up finding, the mathematical physicist finds, is that structure properly called time when there are no temporal durations at a fundamental scale? There is nothing which is an hour, a minute, a second. There might be an arrow, but there is no temporal durations. Does such a structure deserve the name of time? Now, it's often phrased in a strange way. It's usually the case that we get rid of classical geometry in place of some quantum mechanical states. People say, okay, we've done this sort of classical to quantum transition. Let's go and evaluate what the Hamiltonian constraint does with respect to these states. They say, does the Hamiltonian constraint, how does it describe the evolution of these quantum states? We're already talking as though there's evolution. We're already assuming that old T variable still represents time, even though we've gotten rid of temporal duration. Now what we do is we then generate the classical problem of time. We say the Hamiltonian constraint, the dynamics described by the Hamiltonian constraint describe a frozen dynamics. One then says, hey, that's strange. There's a frozen dynamics. That structure T must not model time. And they're willing to throw away time at that level. It's strange to me in my mind that we throw time away, or we say the variable T is no longer appropriate to describe time precisely because the quantum geometry no longer evolves. There's a sense in which what one is committed to is that a changing geometry is an essential or required aspect for the existence of time, such that if geometry does not evolve, there must not be time in the world. This is a non-trivial assumption. But let's go ahead and just set that assumption down on the table and let's not judge it. What the idea is that time requires dynamics. One usually thinks that dynamics requires time, but in this case, one is assuming that time requires dynamics. Now, all this is happening after one has thrown out the metric field, after one has already agreed that there are no such things as temporal durations. And my question is, why are we allowing time to be a structure which doesn't require temporal durations, but does require a sort of geometric evolution? So I want to make this clear is, in order to generate the frozen dynamics, one has to assume that there is dynamics in loop quantum gravity, at least for us to describe, or at least before we approach the Hamiltonian constraint. There has to be a question, is there dynamics in loop quantum gravity? And that question arises, though there are no temporal durations. So this assumes that temporal durations is not being assumed to be an essential component of time. What ends up happening is We then ask the question, what's the dynamics like? What is this Hamiltonian constraint like? We interpret this constraint as being a Hamiltonian constraint, though there is no temporal durations. We find out that there is no dynamics. The dynamics is frozen. And we throw up our hands. We say, wow, there must not be time. This is a strange paradigm to me. It's strange that one would interpret the T variable as still representing time, though there are no temporal durations. But then one gets frustrated when the geometry doesn't evolve with respect to it. In my mind, if time disappears in loop quantum gravity, it's not because the spatiotemporal geometry is frozen. Time disappears because we got rid of the metric field. We got rid of temporal duration. Rid of, in my mind, an essential component of time is temporal duration. What is not, in my mind, an essential component is dynamics. I believe that, at least conceptually speaking, I think of a world that has time or a temporal direction in which things are just frozen. I wouldn't say that the ontology of the world lacks time because of that. However, on the other hand, if you try to describe a world that has time but there is no temporal duration, I'm not so clear that I have a concept of time that fits that description. So in my mind, time goes missing in loop quantum gravity long before one considers a Hamiltonian constraint, long before one even interprets the constraint as describing a Hamiltonian or a quasi-Schrodinger equation.
It almost boils down to metaphysical constitutions of what is time. So
yeah.
You're saying surely a fundamental element of time must be temporal duration. Obviously, as you'd be saying there, because of the mathematics, it doesn't necessarily require that if you're going to go for the corner of dynamics, which is interesting. And that's the reason why a few people, obviously, Max Tegmark's one who believes the term time doesn't exist. And I don't know if you know the physicist Julian Barber, who's got a piece on shape dynamics. So it gets between the two. So just as a general metaphysical question, I had this similar conversation with Bradford Scoe. So do you really think time does require some temporal duration, or is it just because we experience that phenomenologically? That doesn't mean that time exists on that level fundamentally. It's just how we experience it in terms of temporal linearity. But a fundamental quantum level, it might not require that. It might just be the dynamic. So
Yeah. Perhaps
we're just nitpicking it. We require temporal duration. It's an interesting point as to what actually constitutes time. But it sounds like you really want to at least reestablish an element of traditional time in terms of the past, present, and the future.
I agree with half of that. The part that I agree with is, it might be the case that there is something like time fundamentally, which doesn't have duration. We'll have to wait to see how the physics describes that structure. And then it's up to us as humans who use language to see whether or not we want to call that thing time or call it something else. It's just a matter of humans getting together to see how it is we want to use our words and being clear about the concepts which we are naming by our words. Most everyday humans, when we think about time, we're thinking about this phenomenological experience, this thing that we are directly, in a sense, in contact with. If this is the thing that we want to call time, then I say time does not exist in quantum gravity if it doesn't have temporal duration. Now, that thing that we're directly experiencing, that we're going to call phenomenological time or something, it very may well be the case that that's only a psychological event, or structure, that such a thing does not exist in the objective world or at the fundamental scales. I'm not committed to anything like bringing a sort of real traditional notion of time back into the physical world. It's more of how it is that I want to use the word time. I want to use the time to be that thing which I am directly experiencing or seem to be experiencing in my day-to-day phenomenological life. Whether or not there is such a thing, I make no claims. Sorry, that's why I agree with half of it. And with the claim that says in terms of past, present, and future, I don't want to say that's time requires some objective notion of past, present, and future. If general relativity and special relativity are true, that sort of feature of time seems to be false.
Yeah, in terms of the way, obviously, space-time bends, again, goes back to how we experience time vis-a-vis different mathematical and physical theories about it. Is a problem here in terms of when we're talking about time at the quantum level, the theoretical physicists that are far more comfortable using mathematics are more likely to be interested just expressing it with mathematics and something like dynamics, as opposed to actually thinking about what metaphysical time would be and whether that requires temporal duration because they're only interested in a mathematical language?
I can't speak for the whole mathematical physics community. It does seem to be the case that when one is trying to solve the problem of time within that community, it's a mathematical question, and there are certain mathematical properties that are hoping to be discovered. Those mathematical properties may or may not map onto the sort of metaphysics that we have of time, and this is why it will be important for all of us. I usually philosophers of physics, but also just metaphysicians and the everyday moms and dads of the world who are being handed a physical theory which is being interpreted by the mathematical physicists as including something like time. It's up to all of us to then ask, does this structure actually represent the metaphysics which we would come to expect of something like time or of space? And so I don't want to use the phrase a metaphysical time. I don't necessarily want to use that phrase as much as I might want to say the metaphysics of time, where there's only one kind of time, physical time, besides, you know, maybe personal phenomenological time. But in terms of real objective structure, if there is such a thing as time, it's physical time, and it has a particular metaphysics.
And a side note here, so Carlo Rovelli, who does loop quantum gravity, and obviously this is an area that both of you know a lot about. So in terms of dealing with time at the quantum level and having to marry it with aspects of general relativity, what are some of the pros of using loop quantum gravity as opposed to other aspects of potential physical theory and mathematics when we're trying to marry the quantum world with the macro world of general relativity?
Carlo Rovelli knows 100 times more about the subject than I do. I would hate to be put in the same classification as him. He's the person you should talk to about most of these big issues. But since you are stuck with lowly Mia, I'll give it a shot. The other most popular, and by far the most popular, approach to marrying the two concepts is string theory. String theory also will provide us with a quantum description of space and time. At least that's what it hopes and promises to do. There's lots of other ones. There's causal set theory. There's shape dynamics, as you've already described. There is non-commutative geometry. One of the questions you ask is, what's the benefit? There is an ongoing quasi-debate. No one cares too much to get too angry about it, but as to which is the better approach for quantizing gravity. Is it string theory or is it loop quantum gravity? And there are claims made that loop quantum gravity's the benefit of using loop quantum gravity as opposed to string theory is the supposed fact that string theory is background dependent. The idea is that one does string theory on a Minkowski background, i.e. a background that has a fixed geometry. And so one wonders, how can you provide a quantum description of geometry when you assume a fixed geometry to begin with? Whereas in loop quantum gravity, you explicitly take the geometry as encoded in the metric field and give a quantum mechanical description of it. So this is one of the benefits that one claims for loop quantum gravity is that they don't use a fixed background in that sense of the word background. Another benefit is that we are using Dirac's method, and Dirac's method has been successful in other fields for quantizing physical fields. Another criticism, we'll say, of string theory is that string theory has had by far the most funding and the greater number of brains and power working on building us a theory of everything, which includes a theory of gravity, and it has not given us any testable results. And so one thinks maybe that is a dead end. Presumably, perhaps one thinks that if string theory were true, we would have had something more concrete in it by now. Now, I actually don't buy most of those arguments. I don't think any of those arguments are very strong, precisely because, at least with respect to the first one, there are many string theorists who deny that string theory actually is background dependent. They claim that it doesn't assume any particular background topology and that certain, maybe M theory, I'm now speaking outside of something that I don't know a ton about, so you can check these things, dear listeners. M theory has something like a sum over topologies, i.e. sum over structures, each of which has a different topology and geometry. And so it doesn't presuppose any background structure, but in a sense takes all of them into account. Again, I'm only saying this because there are many string theorists who now deny that string theory is background dependent, against the contrary claim from the loop quantum gravity community.
The point you made about, obviously, string theory not giving us any kind of experience we can test or evidence we can directly observe. Leonard Susskind was saying that we might have to redefine what constitutes science and how we practice it, because obviously certain elements of string theory aren't testable, but they do provide many answers. They can be many different kind of different string theories, and obviously they can provide answers to obviously multiple dimensions, multiverses. But yeah, that's quite interesting that some don't even claim it's background dependent.
A brief caveat there. I don't also want to suggest that somehow loop quantum gravity or the other methods of quantizing gravity are somehow superior in providing us with actual empirical tests for their theories. That's not the case. No theory of quantum gravity has been able to provide us with anything like an empirical test that we could perform to verify the theory. I only meant to say that given the vast number of brains and money that have been working on the problem, we still, in string theory, we still don't have anything like an empirical observation with which we can test the theory against.
Are you working on any papers or any, have you got anything published coming out, any books, any papers? Are you working on anything?
So I've got a paper in review right now. I can't mention it since it's supposed to still be blind, but it has to do with the sort of metaphysical implications of loop quantum gravity and how philosophers should be using and thinking about loop quantum gravity or quantum theories of gravity. I've got a paper on the problem of time, which talks a little bit about why I think time goes missing in loop quantum gravity and how not to interpret the Hamiltonian constraint too literally. And I have a project, hopefully, to start engaging with the non-commutative geometry. I'll say that again in case it wasn't clear. To engage with the non-commutative geometry group to see how it is that space and time get represented algebraically within that community. There's a very interesting project called Space from Hilbert Space, which is the idea of building space and time as an emergent structure from just quantum mechanical interactions. And all of these things, all these interesting projects, have one common feature, and that's you have something that can be described purely algebraically, which is supposed to be giving rise to mathematical structures which can be interpreted geometrically. And the question then is if this sort of algebraic redescription of geometry is possible in the physical sense, what does that mean about the fundamental ontology of the world? So these are some projects which I'm dipping my feet into at the moment.
I don't know how much you know about the philosophy of mathematics in general, but the general position in philosophy of mathematics between being a realist of mathematics in terms of like a Platonic sense that mathematics exists ontologically in the world versus something like fictionalism, which is generally an instrumentalist view that it's a good tool to map onto the world. Do you find this relevant to the problem of when we're dealing with time at the quantum level?
Yeah, I do actually think these two questions or these two topics are related. I can't say much intelligible about them. But what we see happening is the descriptions of the world given to us by quantum theories of gravity are becoming much more abstract and esoteric. There's a sense in which the states of our physical systems are looking less and less like physical objects. They are no longer in space. They are no longer in time. They no longer have the same sort of causal relationships with one another. And one starts to think that, you know, they're sliding. There's some sliding between these objects, which are supposed to be physical, and they no longer have the properties which we thought made them physical. And one wonders, what is exactly the ontology of these objects? They start to look a lot more like mathematical objects. Now, we don't want to call them mathematical objects, but there ends up being this blending of ontologies as we now work to distinguish, well, what is it about these objects which make them physical and not merely mathematical structures? So, for instance, one traditionally has thought that an abstract object just is any structure which isn't in space and time. This is a historical distinction, whether or not one believes it. Some people believed it at one point in time, in which case, you know, mathematical objects are abstract precisely because they're not in space and time. Propositions are abstract precisely because they're not in space and time. But here we have the physical objects described by loop quantum gravity are no longer in space and time. There's a sense in which they are supposed to build space and time, in which case, if you're using that historical definition, these physical objects are going to be categorized as abstract objects, like mathematical objects. So one will presumably get rid of that distinction and say that that distinction isn't sufficient for categorizing the difference between concrete physical objects and abstract objects. This is only to say your question is as to the philosophy of mathematics and whether or not it's relevant to the question of ontology and loop quantum gravity. I do think there's an interesting connection, and that's precisely because our physical objects in quantum gravity start to look less and less physical And so we have to work harder to figure out what is it that's physical about them. They begin to look more and more like mathematics.